Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a writer, producer and director of plays, films and video games. In 1997, he left Germany to study theatre at NYU in New York. While a student, my guest began freelancing as a video game journalist, contributing to Next Gen, official Dreamcast magazine, and the legendary Famitsu in Japan. He then joined Treyarch to work on the video game adaptation of Steven Spielberg's Minority Report, a project that set him on the path of cross-media storytelling. His 2014 graphic novel, Ricky Rouse Has a Gun, was named one of the Boston Globe's Books of the Year. And then 2 years later, his debut feature film, The White King, adapted from a Hungarian novel, debuted at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. Later, his theatrical adaptation of Ernest Hemingway's 1926 novel, The Sun Also Rises, became a West End success, described by a reviewer for the Sunday Telegraph as intense, raw and compelling. And most recently, my guest directed C-Smash VRS, a virtual reality-based follow-up to the cult classic arcade and Dreamcast game Cosmic Smash. Welcome, Jörg Tittel.
Thank you very much for this intro. I never lived in Germany, actually. I was born in Belgium, but maybe that explains my sort of...
Did you study there?
No. My dad was German, and that probably explains my sort of cross-media sort of thing, because I'm a cross-media creation myself, because my mom was Polish, my dad was German, I was born in Belgium, and hence I have no identity, or at least no national identity, which I actually kind of enjoy not having. And so therefore I have to do everything and dabble in everything, I guess.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. And the Hemingway adaptation actually was, my wife adapted it and I produced her West End show.
You produced it. Right. Yeah.
Which, so we had founded a production company together and just made plays and films together. And she's not a gamer at all. So I had to, you know, eventually get back to my sort of incredibly nerdy roots. And
yeah.
I mean, I have to say, I feel most at home in games just because they combine everything, you know?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that because obviously you've had some success in all these different areas, graphic novels, films, theatre. Is it video games where you feel you most enjoy telling stories?
Well, I think like now, especially in the way the world has evolved over the last 20, 30 years, where, you know, I mean, everyone has started second screening life, you know, their own children at this point. The one art form where that's not impossible, pretty much, is video games. It's like, yeah, you can do a Twitch stream, I guess, while you play a game, but you do have to, quote unquote, engage with the content, you know, while you play it. And that for a creative person that puts blood, sweat, and tears into a project is reassuring and almost essential. I feel that, you know, when we make films, the only place where they can have a real home, one where the audience will respect it, is on the big screen, is in the cinema. Because at home, we're all distracted away from our films now. I mean, Martin Scorsese masterpieces that I purchased on Amazon end up in the My Stuff folder, you know, and it's just, right, it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, that's such a great point. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, I will sometimes be watching a TV series or a film and then just find myself glancing at Twitter or something and then have to almost sort of make the psychological effort to not do that and put it to one side and engage properly. But yeah, with video games, can't really do that, can you, unless it's a loading screen?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny, it's like with games you have to pay attention, and in VR even more so. I mean, you're trapped inside somebody else's creation, and it's like we almost have to take people hostage now to get there, to have their attention, but it's a kind relationship, I hope. But also games, you know, of course they're immense because they're also the most democratic form of art.
What do you mean by that?
You know, they're the one that doesn't just say, like, it's not just I'm the great artist and here's my thing and you have to enjoy it. It's like, no, I want to see what your input into this thing will be. I want to invite you in. And as games become more and more accessible on mobile platforms, on, you know, like, essentially the idea of the expensive hardware is still there, but we are ultimately democratizing, you know, access to games, even old games that back in the day no one could afford. Now you can get a ROM and check out, you know, your retro favorite, so to speak. I mean, it's amazing that this is not possible with other art forms, really. You know, you can't really enjoy a Van Gogh painting unless you go to a fancy gallery in which it is housed. And with games, we invite people more. So I think it's the evolution of art. You know, it has come to a place where now, you know, games have combined everything from, you know, fine arts to music to architecture to, you know, to theater, to audience participation, all those things, into this beautiful thing that just keeps evolving. I think they're a beautiful thing, games, and they have yet to reach their potential, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. So I've met you once before, Jörg, earlier this year, and if I had to describe your vibe in a word, it would probably be excitable, which is great, very passionate person. But I think you are... My sense is that you are unusually excited about this current project that you've got, C-Smash VRS. It is based on a rather obscure arcade/Dreamcast futuristic sports game. I think, you know, maybe not that many people will have played it. Of course, I've played it. I'm a professional. But for those people who perhaps haven't played it, what was it that you know, drew you to this game in the first place and made you want to update it for a contemporary audience?
You know, it was back in 2001. I had actually just had an article of mine published in Famitsu DC, which was Famitsu's Dreamcast magazine in Japan. And for that magazine, I'd interviewed Yoshitaka Amano.
The artist, yeah.
Yeah, the artist, the artist who created essentially Final Fantasy's, you know, characters and style. And I went to his studio at the time in New York and had interviewed him and took pictures of him in his studio. And I felt completely giddy. And I was just like 19 years old at the time, or 20 or something. And when I received that copy of that magazine, and it was going to be one of the last issues of it, because only a couple of months after that, the Dreamcast would be discontinued by Sega. In that issue, I saw a screenshot of this game and it said Naomi there. So it was released on the Naomi arcade hardware, which shared the same architecture as the Dreamcast. Actually, I have the Cosmic Smash cabinet behind me there.
You do indeed. I could see.
and I got, and I saw that screenshot of just one screenshot of this minimalist sort of almost outline of a player with a sort of futuristic racket and these blocks in the back. And it just conjured up in me these feelings of like, this is the ultimate game. I love this. It just seems to embody everything that I love about games in this one snapshot. And then I saw that it was going to come out in October or November or something at the time. And couldn't wait for it to come out. In the meantime, they discontinued the Dreamcast. And when that game actually came out and landed on my desk, I managed to, you know, snap up an imported copy. The object was just stunning. That case, which was this unusual DVD case. All the other Dreamcast games in Japan came in CD cases.
It was sort of like milky white, wasn't it? So transparent, semi-transparent.
And the orange disc was shining through the milky white front. It was just an absolute design icon. I was like, wow, this is so beautiful and yet so tragic. The fact that this didn't get the, you know, the success that it deserved. And at the same time, almost Rez came on Dreamcast as well, which, you know, of course, Tetsuya Mizuguchi and his then team at United Game Artists had made. And they were, he was friends and worked very closely with Kenji Sasaki, who was the executive producer of Cosmic Smash. And I imagine that they would have had, I've never confirmed this with Tetsuya, but I'm sure they would have looked at what they were doing, what the other teams were doing, because they had things in common stylistically.
Yeah, similar aesthetic, isn't it? Yeah.
And those two games, to me, are timeless. And of course, Res Infinite has had an incredible life in VR and on sort of next-gen consoles. But it was back in 2001 that I really fell in love and I wanted to one day play this in VR, you know, because to me, Sega was always a VR company. You know, it always felt like a virtual reality to me. Ever since I stepped inside an OutRun cabinet in 1986 and my little feet barely touched the pedals, you know, I was just, I stepped inside a headset essentially, right? But it just moved, it took my whole body to a beautiful place. And yeah, so I always wanted
to
make
in the back
game
of your mind.
So it took 20 years.
For that time, yeah. And I mean, we will come back to this a bit later in the chat, but just quickly, tell me, how did you go about securing the rights? Because I guess you can't just walk into Sega's offices in Hammersmith or wherever they're based and go, I want to make Cosmic Smash 2. What did you do?
Well, I mean, firstly, the people at Sega Europe didn't even know what Cosmic Smash is. And they, you know, I think they made some inquiries. I did approach them at first and that didn't go anywhere. And eventually I managed to start talking to Sega in Japan. And even there, you know, I was getting these, you know, almost weird looks from people going like, what, why?
People jumping on Google going, is that one of ours?
What is this? And also, if it is ours, and we looked at and it was only released in Japan. It's like, I know this. It's like, okay. I almost had to convince the rights holders as to why it would be a good idea and why this thing had value, you know, which is kind of a bad way, I guess. But I just felt that it deserved to come back. It had to come back, and it had to come back in this new and evolved form, which I feel should have always been its natural form. You know, it felt like a virtual reality thing because that's what arcade games, again, feel like to me. You know, I feel like I'm stepping inside those worlds rather than sitting on a couch and being sort of separated by the screen, you know.
So then began all the negotiations that you can't talk about, but we've got it anyway. Okay, all right, yeah. So I've asked you to pick the five video games you would like to install in your very own ideal video game console. You've picked five corkers. I think you've actually already mentioned the first title. So why don't you tell us about this? Tell us about this game. What is it? Why do you love it? When did you first encounter it?
My first game is OutRun. OutRun to me is such a seminal game because it is the game that I associate the most with Sega. but it's also a game whose feeling, the feelings that it sort of brings up in you is one of not of escape, but of traveling. Like you feel like you're really traveling somewhere, inviting, you know, the game. The world doesn't hate you. It doesn't try to kill you. You're not trying to mine it or strip it of anything. It's just, it's open to you, and you get to explore it, and you get to choose your own path through it. And one round of it, once you've learned how to master it, you know, can be incredibly fast. It will only take, you know, 10, 20 minutes, depending on how you play it and how hard the difficulty setting you set it to. But it just feels good. The music is stunning. The graphics are timeless. And so that feeling is one that I've been chasing ever since, you know. And very rarely do games bring it back to me. And maybe it is some sort of weird midlife crisis now where I go like, what to feel like that 8-year-old child again.
Mm-hmm. Was there one particular Outrun cabinet that you would personally visit all the time?
Yeah, there was. Well, no, because I was in Brussels at the time, and the way I visited that one was it was part of a traveling circus.
Oh, okay.
And it was a circus, and I mean, imagine the effort like of loading. It was the full size one, and so imagine loading that onto a truck, right? Some massive truck, like these huge trucks, circus, and then unloading it, bring it down the ramp, like building tent, like moving it in, and the tent had a bunch of arcade cabinets.
What?
In it.
Yes,
it was the best.
Well, they just had a generator to power them all.
Yes.
Like next to the lions or whatever.
It was like super loud and the whole town was just vibrating to this like arcade machine generator. But it was
right.
It was stunning. And I played all these incredible games in there. So once a year, literally once summer would arrive and it'd bring arcade games. Yeah. So that's how I played Outrun.
No way. What a great memory. That's so cool. Did you were living in Brussels at the time. Did you move around a lot, or was that where you spent all of your childhood?
No, I didn't move around a lot. My parents were in Brussels because my father was working for the European Commission in Brussels, which this great country of the UK has now separated itself from.
Nothing to do with me, mate.
Yes, I know. He was one of the evil sort of, you know, bureaucrats in Brussels.
Right.
But no, he was a great guy, my dad. And my mom was a composer, a Polish film composer, and also operas and symphonic music and chamber music.
Mm.
And so I was growing up in Brussels, but spending quite a lot of time in France because my parents had a house there in the south. And so it was mostly spent between Belgium and France, really, before I then moved to the States.
Did you feel any pressure to learn an instrument and all of that stuff follow after your mum?
You know, I did. I felt pressured, and I don't like being put under pressure. And I also felt that I would never be able to compete with my mother, but I always be in the shadow of my mother if I was to become a musician. And I love to sing, and I'm a musical person. And I adore music, and most of my friends are musicians, actually. But I just felt like, you know, my mother was a genius. You know, she wrote her first concerto when she was 6 years old. You know, there's no way I would ever be able to to measure up to that. And so that's how but stories and telling stories and entertaining people is something that I loved to do the most. And I felt that games were, you know, ever since I was little, would be, you know, the place where you could do that, where you could really, you know, create art, some sort of new form of art. And my mother believed me, like, you know, whenever she would go and travel somewhere, the concert or something, to America or something. Can you please buy me a CDX or some other obscure game system? It's very important for me because one day I want to be making games. So it's like for research purposes, Mom, you know? And yeah, my father was completely just shocked every time he'd come back with some sort of new video game.
Come back with a massive box next to a violin or whatever she plays.
Yeah. But, you know, so I have to thank my mom for it. She believed that I was onto something, which is great.
Oh, that's quite interesting. It's funny how kids pick up on the way in which the optimum way to pitch their parents on how they should be allowed a particular toy or video game system, isn't it?
Like, yes. Yes. It was always games were always about pure productivity for me, of course.
Well, yeah, and you released a game earlier this year called The Last Worker, so it's that's maintained, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, The Last Worker was an interesting one because that was a game that I've spent many, many years making, like at first on my own and then sort of like gathering up the cast or gathering to cast together of Jason Isaacs and Olafur Darri Olafsson and all these wonderful people. And then eventually teaming up with this amazing team at Wolf and Wood up in Newcastle, Ryan Bousfield and his team of people of amazing developers. And it's so interesting that in the meantime, Cosmic Smash came, or C-Smash, and then for that matter, came together. And Ryan, who's equally a madman to me, I think, agreed to do it. So suddenly we were making two games at the same time.
Extra productive. I'm sure your parents would be pleased.
Yeah. Yes. Sadly, they're not here to see it. But I'm finally doing something.
You made good on your childhood promise.
Yes. So. Only took me half a lifetime to get there. But, you know, better late than never.
Okay, yeah. Let's come to your second game then. Tell us about this one.
My second game is Heart of Darkness. Heart of Darkness is a side scrolling. It's actually not scrolling. If you go, you move mostly screen from one screen to another.
Yeah.
And you're a little boy whose dog gets snatched by these dark forces of evil, and by these shadow creatures. And so this boy goes on this adventure. He takes a spaceship to try and chase after these shadow beasts. And ends up in another world, where he tries to get his dog back. His dog was called Whiskey, actually. I think you'd be allowed to call the dog after an alcoholic drink anymore in a video game. But you know, those were rock and roll days back then.
The '90s.
Oh man, we I was drinking whiskey while playing it, actually, just to be one with a dog. But yes, and that game is just stunning. The animation is absolutely stunning. It is an evolution of the, you know, quote unquote formula that Epic had started with Out of This World. But here the animation was truly cinematic. And the thing that also made it absolutely stunning was that the cutscenes, which were at the time they were pre-rendered, but they would seamlessly blend with or flow into the gameplay. There were no load times, and which was only possible because of the PlayStation. Interestingly, it was originally in development for the Saturn, but then the Saturn was failing as a system, and so, you know, they had to change strategy. So it would have been a Sega exclusive originally. But yes, clearly I'm in love with all the sort of could have been sort of Sega games and Sega successes. but that game is just brutally hard and incredibly engaging. And it's a puzzle platformer, essentially, because you have to, even though you've got action scenes, the action itself also requires intelligence and strategy. It would take another sort of couple of decades after that for another game to do this again, and in 2D, so to speak, and that would be Inside, which is heavily inspired by Heart of Darkness, another great game, of course. Mm-hmm. It also came with those 3D glasses.
Did it?
Huh. And you only got to enjoy the 3D bit when you finished the game, and the end sequence was a 3D movie.
That's your payoff.
Yes. Originally, they were going to make everything in 3D, I think. And then sort of, they ran out of budget, I think. And then, but still the glasses were awesome. And it was a huge hit, which I didn't know. Eric told me this. It was actually a massive financial success, even though people were, you know, talking about how it's going to be doomed because, you know, who wants to play 2D games anymore?
Right, yeah.
And we all like 3D now and blah, blah, blah. And the one thing that actually took some of the wind out of its sail was Oddworld, which came out a year beforehand.
Yes.
But was heavily inspired by it because Lorne Lanning had actually seen the game backstage at a CES like 3 years prior, you know.
Oh, I see, right, yeah.
And so that always pissed me off, actually. I'm like, dude, there's some sequences that have been literally just like like taken out of it. Like him tumbling down a hill and then letting him falling on his butt, and then you're inside the game. That was in there.
Well, look, that just may have been a happy accident, Jörg. I don't want any lawyers writing to me. So.
I'm not saying that was necessarily, you know, borrowed from the game, but still, if anything, I would have wanted people to experience that in Heart of Darkness first, because that game was in development far longer.
Yeah.
Than Oddworld, and I love Oddworld, by the way. It's one of my all time favorite games as well. So, you know. It's just an interesting fact.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So tell me, how did you come to move to NYU then to study theatre? So you're living between France and Belgium at this time, and then what takes you over there?
Well, I wanted to become an actor, and I just graduated. Did you graduate from high school? I guess you do. And I really wanted to go to the UK, and I wanted to go to London because that's where theatre resides. And I was also incredibly disorganized and didn't fill out the application forms fast enough in order to go to a acting school or a conservatory or something in London. And because I wanted to go to RADA, you know, and
sure,
but it seemed possible in New York, which would have, you know, in New York, everyone's dream as well as an actor. And so I applied to, I had to audition at NYU, at Tisch School of the Arts, and prepared a couple of...
What did you do for your audition?
I did Mark Anthony's speech from Julius Caesar, even though they specifically asked to not see any Shakespeare monologues.
No Shakespeare.
And so I said, since no one was going to do Shakespeare now, I'm going to do it. So yeah, so I definitely stood out with that one. And that one was fun. And then I also did a monologue from a play by Patrick Süskind, who is the author of The Perfume, a great novel, which was then turned into a okay film. I did a monologue from his play called The Double Bass, which is a comedic sort of tragicomic monodrama or play for one actor. Mm. And I performed that audition or that monologue for them in five languages, because I thought, because I speak five languages, and I thought it'd be quite fun to just show them that I can act in, or maybe can't act, that there was for them to judge in five different languages.
That's a big flex, Jörg. Very impressive.
Well, you know, I thought, you know, acting is all about standing out. But then I also realized that, you know, while studying, and I did lots of plays, lots of shows, and I love being on stage. I've been on stage since as well, but I just didn't like the lifestyle of an actor. It felt so lonely to me, and it's so dependent on other people's love all the time. Yes. And I just didn't want to be judged in 10 seconds on my looks, which aren't great. You know, there's a lot of overcompensating that my looks require.
I reject that.
Well, maybe I'm blossoming late, you know.
So how did you start freelancing for these magazines then while you're studying to be an actor?
Well, within a few months of landing in New York and being there and going to that very expensive, you know, educational institution, my parents didn't have a lot of money, and it was going to be a struggle for them to keep me there, and because I'd made some unfortunate business decisions in their lives at the time. And so I was faced with the reality that we wouldn't be able to, you know, they wouldn't be able to keep me there. And so it was basically going to be, you know, I have to find some money or I have to go back to Europe. Yes. And that idea just freaked me out. I just loved it so much in New York. It felt like I really just belonged there. But I was at the same time feeling very vulnerable one day, and like a kid, I was just like, I felt completely helpless. And so I crawled back to the thing that was my happy place, which was video games. And so I went down into the computer sort of room in the dorm at NYU, in my dorm, and I visited the website for my favorite German video game magazine, Maniac, at the time, who was also my bread and butter back in Belgium, because the way I would buy new games is I would send them cheat codes, and they'd send me money. They actually sent cash.
In exchange for cheats.
In exchange for cheats. And I was cheating at the cheat codes, I have to admit, because at first, I actually literally spent days like doing up A, right A, right A at the main screen, usually on the main menu. And eventually, sometimes it would work, right? And I was like, yeah, I hit the jackpot, and then I'd send it in, and they'd send me money.
Get 10 euros.
But then I really felt like I was really wasting my time doing that. And so I had this idea. I went into my favorite little import magazine shop in Brussels, and they had Famitsu there. And since the Japanese versions would come out about, 3 to 6 months before the Western release, their cheat section was way ahead of ours. And so I would just translate their cheats and then just send them in.
Wow.
But I would always have to wait, because I'd have to wait to at least make sure that the game was out.
So they were essentially paying for your translation services. So I think it's, ethically okay.
Okay, perfect. Well, the translation would usually just be a left and a right arrow and a button. But yeah, sure. But yes, I've already come clean to the editors of Maniac. They know, and they've forgiven me since. So it's fine. I guess I must have also associated them not just with my happy place, but also with money. So maybe I contacted them, but I didn't ask them for a job or anything. I just said, hello, I missed. Can you send me a copy here to New York? Because I really miss it. I know I can subscribe from the US and blah, blah, blah. And the editor-in-chief, a lovely guy, Vinny Foster, he just responded to me and said, like, we're actually looking for a U.S. correspondent right now. Can you write? And I'm like, yeah, maybe. And so I started writing for them. And since I was quite active on ICQ and AOL Instant Messenger and other sort of in emerging chat platforms, also trying to sort of make contact with my favorite game developers, I landed my first world exclusive.
Which was what?
which was Giant Citizen Kabuto,
oh, yes.
I think. I think it was either that or it was two at the same time. It was that, which was an incredible game. And also another one was a company called Big Blue Box at the time. It was working on an as of yet unannounced game for Xbox. Well, but it wasn't Xbox yet, because they didn't know what they were making it for yet, and it was going to be Fable.
Right.
And so I became friends with Dean and Simon Carter, the Carter brothers, the creators of Fable. And this was before they were even working with Peter Molyneux on it, etc. And they said they were working on a big epic sort of RPG narrative thing. And so I also had the first sort of teaser reveal of that. And that got the attention of Next Generation Magazine. Yeah. And then I started working for them. And
you were off.
Et cetera. So I was off.
Okay, we better come to your third game. What is this one? And tell me why you love it.
My third game is Ridge Racer Type 4. Ridge Racer Type 4 is another just incredible design icon, and it's a game that has the best soundtrack to this day. Well, perhaps, once we've had our time to our way with it, but Ridge Racer Type 4 is a game that I play and replay all the time. It's after Outrun and Sega Rally, my favorite racing title. It's extremely hard to be really, really good at it. But it just feels like you're flowing, and it feels like you're dancing. Your car is dancing in that game. It feels like you're lounging, like you're partying at night. It takes you to just a different place. And the graphic design of it, the menus, the everything, the presentation, the feel of it is just perfect. It's, you know, I can't think of another game that has that is packaged and sort of executed in a stylisher way as Ridge Racer Type 4. I adore that game so much.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? Yeah. The previous guest, Phil Fish, creator of Fez, is the only other person to have picked it, but I think it's one of the best racing games, certainly. And not just because it's so good at racing it, but it's the whole feel of the game, isn't it? It's the environments, the time of day at which you're racing, and then the soundtrack and the cars and everything. It's such an immense vibe.
It makes total sense why Phil would love that, because, you know, his game... You know, I mean, Fez is a game. I mean, I would have totally added that to my... If you had given me 10 games to put on my favorite console, I would have added Fez, because he... You know, what he's managed to do with that game as well is, like, everything is integrated. Everything is just perfect.
Yeah, holistic.
Within a thing. It's holistic, yes. Yeah. It's organic. It's a creature, you know, the whole thing. And Ridge Racer Type 4 is a creature as well. It's a being, you know, and that can only happen when the team is entirely in sync with each other. And you can see that they all had the same philosophy. They were sharing a feeling, and they're infusing everything with that feeling. It's gorgeous. Mm. It's gorgeous. I've learned so much Amazing. From that game.
So tell me, you moved to Treyarch and start working with Activision on Spielberg's Minority Report. What was that like? This is the first adaptation, I guess, that you're working on. And in your career, that seems to have been a bit of a theme. You know, what was it like joining that team? And what were you given to work from? Was the film finished?
Well, it's really interesting. I was giving nothing. Actually, the reason I worked for it was almost out of a place of despair, because I was in New York. It was 9/11. And shortly after 9/11, and I was, you know, the horrors that the whole city there and the country and the world really endured with that event. It turned out that my visa was completely messed up. And because, again, I was a bit lazy about paperwork, and also NYU had messed it up. And so it turned out that I'd been in the U.S. In a sort of slightly dodgy status for a year and a half without knowing it.
Oh, right. Wow.
And people had noticed it, you know, when I was traveling back and forth, thankfully for me. But at the same time, you know, I could have probably done something about it. So there I'm in this precarious position. And so I sent out an email to all my contacts in the industry, but also friends, et cetera, in the U.S. saying that I'll likely be leaving in the U.S. It's been really great to be here, but I'll probably have to return to Europe for, you know, silly reasons, etc. And like within an hour, I get an email from this guy, Alan Barish, who I'd met, who said like, "Hey, dude, you can work at Treyarch. We're making this game, and I feel we could use your expertise because no one can write here. And since you're studying theater, maybe you can write." So I went on that job interview, and the job interview was a disaster. Like, I was talking to this guy, Dr. Peter Aikman, one of the founders of Treyarch, and a programmer, and he asked me, so York, what programming languages do you use? I'm like, I don't. Oh, what? This is a tech heavy company. We're like a tech led game developer, and so you would need to know how to code here. And I was like, I'm sorry, but that's just not what I do. I'm a writer and sort of direct. I want to direct, and you know, it's like, yeah, well, maybe you should read C++ for Dummies. And he handed me this book, and like, come back to me and see if you understand the basic principles. And I said that, but how about, okay, no, I'm sorry, but I won't do that. And he's like, oh, like this. And he's like, yeah, because I don't think that I should be doing that. I think, how about I sit down with a really skilled young programmer and design a tool that would allow idiots like myself to build levels and therefore be able to focus on what we know how to do well, which is sort of writing characters and things, which I feel games could really use at this stage, right? Especially one based on a Steven Spielberg movie. It's like, oh, okay. And so I thought I'd completely messed it up. And then they offered me a job.
Nice.
Which was great. but we had absolutely no access to the
film.
To the film. They gave us no access to the film. I was told by the producer, one of the producers there, he said, like, well, I've read the script and I can walk you through it. And I'm like, yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a high security situation. You know, it's, we're under multiple NDAs. You know, we cannot, you know, the junior team members cannot read it and all that stuff. And I was, and I had my sort of 2 or 3 month sort of review meeting at Activision HQ, just like within like stone's throw of Bobby the Hutt Kotick's office.
Don't say anything libelous.
Did I say anything?
Not yet.
Okay. And I was in a meeting with a producer at Activision. So he's like, you know, the boss of the Treyarch producer, essentially.
Yeah.
And he's so how is it going? You know, how was your experience here so far? We've had some positive feedback on your performance and all that jazz. And I go, it's great. I don't know how my performance could be positive because I have no idea what the film is about. You know, I've been given this thing. I have no idea. I mean, it seems like we're doing something that goes counter to what the film is about. Yeah, well, that's because we can't use Tom Cruise's likeness. That's not part of the license agreement.
It's like a comedy, isn't it? It's like if you were writing, I mean, it's like a script for something where you go, awful. This is too far-fetched.
It was awful. And you know how the film was about predicting violence and murder, and you had these precogs characters, and they could... And they were tied into some cables and computers, and like you couldn't even commit a crime because they would predict your crime ahead of you doing it. You get arrested ahead of time and whatever. So what did Treyarch decide to make? What kind of game did they decide to make? Is a brawler where you walk around and throw people out of windows, and you go like,
yeah,
hang on a second, and I say, yeah, just ride around that. So I don't know, they've turned off the precog department or something temporarily, and so I'm like, but that's not the point of the whole thing. We're missing a whole point. This is bullshit. Like, so anyway, but that's what we're doing, they said. Okay. Anyway, I was in that meeting, and at some point, he was actually called into Mr. Kotick's office. Mm. And so during that time, I looked at the little sort of filofax with all the phone numbers, and I called up the production office of the film. I did.
No, you didn't.
And I said,
well, like Amblin.
It was at Fox, I believe, or whatever the studio was.
Oh, Fox. Okay. Yeah.
And I said, excuse me. Hi. I'm calling you here from Activision, and I'm technically a writer on a junior writer on this on the game on the Minority Report game. And they go like, "There's a game?" I was like, "Yeah. There's. I guess this is probably something that went straight only through your marketing department, but we're working on a game, and some of us are really passionate about making a really good game, and I'd love to do that myself. The problem is I haven't read the script, so." Do you think I could read the script? Oh, yeah, sure. Just where are you right now? Activision headquarters, is that just the address? What's your name? Great, cool. We'll send you a copy right away. And I'm like, really? Yeah, sure. Okay. So the meeting continues. He comes back, you know, he sits down or whatever. And literally within 20 minutes, this guy in a motorcycle helmet comes in and goes like, Mr. Tittle! And this courier hands me this, and the producer goes like, "What is this?" I'm like, "Oh, that's the script. The script to the movie." And I say, "What do you mean? What movie? What Minority Report? I just asked for it. Don't worry, it's cool. Like they're totally cool with it." So that didn't put me in the greatest stead, unfortunately, with most people.
Well, with the middle management, I guess we're pretty cross that you cut out their jobs there.
Middle management was essentially creative directing this project, which explains the quality of that game. But I'm very, very proud, actually, of one moment. Again, we sat down with a couple of junior programmers one night. We bought ourselves a 12-pack of beers. And we stole some of the sort of web-slinging code from Spider-Man team, which was downstairs at Treyarch. And we built the sort of tunnel chase sequences as a sort of little proof of concept, which turns out to be the only thing that's fun in the Minority Report game. Because, I mean, the one thing that we knew is there was a tagline on the poster that had been a teaser poster which said, "Everybody runs." And so, yeah, let's have him run away from something. And the easiest way to do that would be on a jetpack in the tunnel. And so, yeah, so those little bonus interstitial levels Amazing. Were created by a few young rebels who were just kind of sick with all this middle management Wow. nonsense.
One incredible snapshot into a now disappeared period of video game development, I think.
Yes, thankfully. The license-based, the game based on license for license sake time is
mostly dead.
Exactly, yeah. Mostly dead. Right, let's come to your fourth game then, Jörg. So tell us about this one. What is it and why do you love it?
My fourth game is Portal 2. Portal 2 is a game that, to me, was the perfect combination of storytelling and gameplay, puzzle mechanics, world building, and everything sort of seamlessly, beautifully integrated. And it's just so delightful to play, and it really just like pushes your brain and your brain cells to their limit. And also, you could play it together with someone else. I mean, it's the first game that I really, truly played co-op with someone else. And to figure things out together rather than just shooting stuff and killing things was amazing. Like it is just an absolutely perfect game. I love it. And you know, I've since also become friends with Chet and Falasek, who actually wrote the co-op missions in the game, or at least one of the writers on it. A great guy, and it's just a game that puts an instant smile on my face.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also, you're someone who has written and talked about a lot the dominance, I suppose, of the gun as the interactive tool used in video games. And it's, I suppose, interesting in that sense as well, because it's, you are essentially firing a weapon, but of course it's a passive projectile it's sending. You fire once to create a magical portal, and then you fire a second time to do the exit for that portal, and then you can walk between them. So it's a game that is sort of solved with a gun, but not in the traditional way.
Yeah.
Is that something that's important to you as well?
It is, because I you know, it's interesting. I had this interesting conversation at the really wonderful Reboot Develop Blue conference in Dubrovnik. Like, I was hosting a panel on VR design and the future of VR design. And one of the panelists, Doug, he had this interesting comment, which I hadn't really thought about, I hadn't really realized at that point, was that technically the controller is a gun, like because of the triggers.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah,
when you think about real world uses of triggers, we don't have them anywhere really except guns, and then perhaps, you know, a power hose, which is why Power Wash Simulator, I guess, is so popular. But it's true. It's like a sort of the dominant thing. It's like it's kind of the most mechanically complex element on controllers as well. It's the one that has haptics built in. It's like, you know, the most effort has been put into this trigger. And I did a little bit of research on that a couple of days ago, actually. It was the N64 controller, or the first one that had a trigger on it. It was, they did it for GoldenEye specifically.
Right.
So thank you, Nintendo. I thought you were family friendly. But no, it's guns are interesting. I have played lots and lots of violent games in my days, and I still do. It's just like it's almost like when it is taken for granted that I just start to feel a little bit icky about it. It's just boring. It's like it's the easiest way to deal with the problem is to kill someone. You know, I mean, and the problem is you never have to deal with the consequences of that action in games, or very rarely. It's just like it's in the real world. It's a dumb thing to do. It's easy as hell to kill someone. I mean, I like the in-between points, you know, the negotiation, the hang on a second, can we just hug this out or something?
Yeah. It's a problem with, I suppose, game engines are so good at rendering physics and ballistics, and that stuff's very easy to like calculate the movement of a projectile through 3D space.
Yeah.
The things you're talking about, negotiation, you know, human emotion, reading the tells on a person's face, all of that's much, much harder, isn't it?
Yeah, but it also inspired me. I mean, a portal inspired me, and also wanting to challenge the idea of the gun or of killing or destruction as a sort of leading game mechanic inspired me to make The Last Worker, you know, where I felt that, you know, the thing that I find the most destructive right now in society is not being killed quickly by a bullet, but slowly being killed by automation and by being replaced, by being rendered useless by sort of big capitalism, sort of big tech. And Amazon being a very good example of that, where you work in these fulfillment centers and you essentially only have to follow orders that are on a PDA that is beeping, you know, down the seconds between each package that you've picked up from the shelves. And I thought, wow, that's the most dystopian video game. It's like, you know, people, you know, hundreds of thousands of pickers, as they call them in the world, have to do this dystopian video game, play it while, you know, damaging their bodies and souls, you know, in these places the size of multiple football stadiums, you know, on concrete and metal and with no natural light, you know, 10 miles a day sometimes.
Yeah.
And you go like, wow, that's I want to make a good video game about this.
Yeah.
And
yeah, you're right. It's already quite video game like the beeps that you're having to do fulfillment within,
yes,
all of that.
Yeah, the points, yeah. They get points. You get points for showing up late, you know, negative points.
Right.
And if you reach a certain number of points, then you get, you know, fired, right? But I also feel that mechanics should have meaning. And very often in games, the mechanics are separated from the meaning. You know, you have almost have stories projected onto something that is essentially still Tomb Raider 30 years later.
Yeah, they're always the best games are always the ones that manage to marry the two, aren't they? So you've got a resonance between the mechanic and the story. Yeah. Okay, why don't we come to your fifth and your final game, Jörg? Tell us about this one, which you are, of course, very close to. What's this game and why do you want to put it on your console?
You know, I mean, my console so far is a flat / pancake game system, as they call it. But there had to be a VR game on there because I've always wanted to be inside these incredible holodeck experiences one day. And it's also because Tetsuya, in a previous episode of your fine podcast, put his own game in his top five.
He put a couple on there. Yeah.
He put two. Okay, so yeah. I felt it would be potentially, you know, the opposite of humble if I put my own game in there. But since he's put two, allow me one. And also he's one of my heroes, by the way. So he should have put five of his games in there, because I mean, Sega Rally was so nearly in my top five. It's just the perfect racing game as well.
What's the game?
Oh, sorry. Go on. My fifth game is C-Smash VRS. C-Smash is a game that, you know, my friends at Wolfenwood, who I've also already, you know, made The Last Worker with, and I have been working on with incredible people like Corey Schmitz, graphic designer, and Archetype, another amazing graphic designer in the game industry, in and out of the game industry, and with Kenny Shi, the incredible
DJ.
Musician,
yeah.
who's also written a track for Rez, actually, in the past. And Danalog, who wrote music, who is part of the two incredible bands, The Comet Is Coming and Soccer 96. And so and Rob Davis, incredible comic book artist and art director on the game. And we've all sort of joined forces on this title and brought back Cosmic Smash.
So just for anyone who hasn't played the original or seen footage of your new one, it's essentially a bit like squash in space. Is that how you describe it?
Yeah, squash in space. Squash meets breakout in
yes, that's
space,
right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
This beautiful sort of minimalist utopian vision of space. Mm. You know, after working on this dystopia, this fun but also dark dystopia of The Last Worker, we working on Sea Smash has been almost like a palate cleanser and a vacation, you know, from all of that existential dread. We wanted to build a utopian experience and one that is incredibly inviting, and it makes you feel good in your body and also makes you feel good either alone or with someone else, because you can play it online and your full body is in the game.
It is full body because it's a racket sport. You're sort of knocking a squash ball against, like you say, a breakout wall of bricks on the other side. And every time your ball strikes one, the brick disappears. The idea is to get rid of all the bricks as fast as you can. And in VR, you need a bit of space, you know, to play the game, don't you? Because you're swinging your arm around and, you know, lining up backhands and slice shots and all of that.
Yeah, we released a demo in March. The full game is coming out on the 23rd of June, but we released a demo in March, and we've had multiple tweets, I'm afraid, of people smashing things.
Oh, jeez. Sea smashing, yeah.
Things in there. So we haven't been really sort of promoting that a whole lot on the socials, but there was one couple of streamers actually in Japan who actually smashed their brand new 55-inch Sony plasma TV.
Oh, jeez.
It's not my fault, okay? Like, people should set their sort of like safety settings and like set up their space properly before they play any VR game.
Did you get Corey Schmitz to do a very nice little disclaimer for you in beautiful?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, him and Dan. Yeah. But they still pre-ordered the game, and they're still following the game on Twitter. And so I think that is testament to how much fun it is. I feel really, really sorry for that TV. And hopefully it was insured and everything. I don't know. But it is, your whole body is inside of it. And it's incredible because it's not just floating hands like in most VR games, or it's like you have legs in it, your arms are attached. You can play it seated or standing as well, and we don't favor anyone based on either of those choices. So you could be actually playing it fully physically in your couch as well if you want, and it's just a blast. We play it in our spare time, which is kind of crazy. It's so much fun. That's the first time I've had this experience of anything that I've ever worked on where I don't get tired of it. I don't want to have a break from it. I mean, we do have breaks, of course, but the fact that you're enjoying your own creation is new to me. Yeah. Like, I've done so many dark stories and so many things, but here it's just a blast. So I love it. I genuinely want to play this game like all the time.
Lovely. Very nice. Yeah, it looks fantastic as well, I have to say. Really very handsome video game, very stylish.
Yeah, and also there's some new modes now. There's a body smash mode where you don't smash bricks. You actually want to hit the other player with a ball. And in a super narrow sort of corridor, both of you have a ball at the same time, and either of the balls can cost you a point. It is insane. It is so much fun. People are giggling like crazy playing it. It's insane. Like, people just get giddy playing it. It's awesome. It's like, so I can't wait for people to play that, you know, at the end of June. It's really genuinely make me very, very happy.
Oh, I hope it's a big success.
Thank you.
Right. Yeah. Let's go through your console then. So we've got Outrun, Heart of Darkness, Ridge Racer Type 4, Portal 2, and Sea Smash VRS. How are you feeling about that?
I feel really good about it. I feel good about the fact that I can, sometimes I think of your show a little bit as a desert island games, but because I do imagine myself ending up on this island with this, my perfect console. And if I don't have a companion on the island, hopefully there's an internet connection.
Yeah, that's fine.
Is that fine?
Okay, I'm really, really good Wi-Fi.
Okay, great. Oh, perfect. Yes. So the idea that I can play Portal 2 with people somewhere else makes me very happy. The fact that I can keep fit, you know, because I don't know how big that island is, walking, you know, might not make me fit. So I could play Sea Smash, keep fit with that. And then there's others, you know, there won't be enough room for a car. So the these two racing games.
I'd say the island is not part of the fiction that I'm giving you, Jörg. So you have to sort your own parking out on your island, you know, if that's where you choose to play your console.
Okay.
It's a very different show.
Okay. I lack an imagination, clearly, you know. But also I believe that your show will be the biggest show, bigger than that other show that I mentioned. So, you know.
We'll see. Okay, yeah, just before I let you go, you know, I've mentioned there that you obviously have a talent for adaptations. That's something that you're very interested in, and you have been ever since you first worked on The Minority Report. Are there any other properties that you'd like to adapt? You know, I suppose people would be interested to hear if there's another Dreamcast game you'd like to update now that you've got an in with Sega.
Yes, I won't say which.
Oh, come on, give us three and I'll tell you which one I hope it is.
God, no, I'm not going to do that.
Give us five.
Okay.
You can't just say yes. I want to
okay.
do
one. Okay, I'll say. But I might not say yes. I might not say yes if you get it right. Let's do it that way.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
I'll give you five different Dreamcast games. We got to do some really random randoms. Ferrari 355.
Okay, you won't get the license for that, but yeah. God, so we're down to four.
Oh my God. So Dreamcast specifically, or okay. Oh my God. Jet Set Radio.
Mm, lovely.
Choo Choo Rocket.
Yep.
Was there a House of the Dead? House of the Dead.
Okay.
And Samba de Amigo.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that'd be great. All right.
Oh, wait, that's coming out in August. Like, Sega's actually making that in August.
Oh, are they? Okay. Yeah, but yeah. Not, they keep re-releasing that, but they don't have the plastic maracas, which is what you need. That's what they had with the Dreamcast one, which is what made it so good. So. Because they did one on Wii, didn't they, where you just had to use the little controllers that weren't quite as good.
Yeah, here it's going to be on Switch, I think. It's a Switch exclusive, I think.
Okay.
So I guess you can use the thingies, the Joy-Cons, but yeah, the maracas are awesome. I still have my maracas, and I love that game so much. It's the original.
Yeah.
New one. I hope they do it right. It'd be great. It'd be great if they sort of revived it.
Well, to be frank, I'd like to see a return of any of those five. So let's hope that you get one of them. That would be great.
Yeah, I'm also working on an original title with the world's best narrative designers. It can be a very lonely experience working on games for many years, and so I now want to make a game quickly but with the best people, so we can all sort of enjoy the fruit of our labor, not 3 or 4 years after lonely, you know, being stuck at home or whatever working on the stuff. So that's one of my next things. Yeah. I'm very excited about it. So,
oh, great. Yeah. Well, we will all watch this space and be excited to see what you do next. So, thank you so much, Jörg. It's been great to talk to you and hear your stories, especially about the Minority Report.
Yeah, thank you. It was a crazy time. And it's games. I mean, I think there's some amazing stories forming in the current state of the game industry. You know, I'm hearing so much stuff. It's like we're in so much flux right now. We always have been because we're new, you know, as an art form. But it is a fascinating medium, and your show is a great one to listen to, because it's rare that we actually get to hear from the creators and from the people that are essential in sort of shaping this as a cultural medium. And so thank you for having me, and thank you for inspiring me.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thanks, Jörg. Thank you so much to my guest, Jörg Tittel. You may have noticed there, he has a game out this week. Out on Friday, it is C-Smash VRS, or Cosmic Smash 2, as I prefer to refer to it. It's out on the Friday, the 23rd of June, 2023. So you'll be able to get that in a few days' time if you're listening to this podcast when it's hotly dropped. But if you're listening to this in the future, then you can just pop along and find that. It's out on PlayStation VR 2, so you do need to own that particular piece of kit. I did speak to Jörg a little while ago, and I think he was maybe investigating the potential of bringing it to other headsets. I'm not quite sure what the deal is they've got with Sega or with Sony or any of the ins and outs of that, but perhaps it will be available on other VR platforms and maybe even non-VR platforms at some point in the future. Who knows? You can also always track down a copy of the original Cosmic Smash for Dreamcast or for the Naomi arcade cabinet if you own one of those. I'm sure many of you do. Listeners to My Perfect Console, you're all elite gamers, aren't you? One other thing. So in all of the excitement where I was asking Jörg to give me five Dreamcast games, and I was going to guess which one he's working on next. I forgot to ask him for a name for his console. Very amateurish. I apologise, Jörg. I did then write to him and say, could he please supply one, and was highly apologetic, of course. And Jörg wrote to me, I think I'd probably call my perfect console the Cosmos. I'm that much of a Sega nerd, and a fitting name for a console that holds a whole universe of games within it. Very much on brand there from Jörg, but a good name for a console, I think. The Cosmos. There we go. Right, that was great. I loved hearing from Jörg. If you want to hear more from Jörg, I didn't actually mention this before now, but he has recently launched a podcast of his own that he presents with Chantal Ryan, who is a game thinker and developer from Australia. It is called Directional Podcast. You can find out more of it if you just search up Directional Podcast, and you'll be able to find out more about what Jörg is doing there. I think they're doing some interviews and stuff like that, and just general chat about where video games are headed. I absolutely loved hearing Jörg's stories, in particular what an amazing scene from Activision all those years ago, that little team working blind on Minority Report, a very vivid scene. And I'm sure some of you listening to this may have worked on movie tie-ins in the past. Perhaps you've got PTSD and you're rocking in the corner. But yeah, not really a kind of game that's made anymore. Although there was a Lord of the Rings Gollum release, wasn't there, a few weeks ago. But nowadays, I think most movies, when they come out, the marketing teams just try and stick their characters in Fortnite or something. Does the job. So yeah, it was nice to get a sense of that vanished world of the movie tie-in. Sounds horrendous, to be honest. Probably good riddance, but anyway, I'm sure some of them were good. I can't think of any right now, but the Lord of the Rings real-time strategy games were pretty good, weren't they? But yeah, maybe write in, let me know what your favourite movie tie-in games were from the 90s and early 2000s. I thought I'd read out a little bit of correspondence. Not sure if I'm going to be doing this every episode, but yeah, had some emails here that I thought I might share with you. This is a nice one from a chap called Paul Morris. I've been enjoying your podcast very much. Unusually relaxed and thoughtful look at games and the game industry. Thank you, Paul. He says, one small piece of feedback is I would like a little more formal introduction on what each chosen game is, as well as how it's played. That is a fair point. I'm aware that not every listener would have played every game. In fact, I have not played every game that comes up on this podcast. So I will endeavour to try to ask my guests to explain what's going on in their picks a little more thoroughly. I have got lots and lots of episodes that I've already recorded. So yes, that's going to sort of come in gradually, I would say, over the next few weeks and months. But yeah, I will try and lock down a bit more what happens in each game that's under discussion. And actually, quite a few people have also emailed just to say, can I repeat the names of the games as well, because you can't always catch it when the guest states it. So I will try and do that as well, and I do repeat them at the end of the episode, which was some early feedback on the podcast that came from my friend Tom Fenwick, told me to do that. So yes, I will try and just make that clearer as well. Nice email here from Tom White. He said, I just wanted to send you a note to say thank you for a wonderful podcast. Thank you very much, Tom. I've always loved gaming, but never had much of a community to share that love with. Your podcast feels a bit like that. It's only the second gaming podcast I've ever loved. The other is A Life Well Wasted, a very, very good podcast. That is not many episodes, but each one thoroughly, brilliantly produced, and you should go and listen to those. That's me speaking there. This is back to Tom. Happily, my five-year-old stepson is just getting into games, and we've cracked out a few of my old consoles as an introduction, which feels synergistic to your podcast too. That's very... very sweet message there. Let's see. Here's one from James Campbell, who says, I've listened to all the episodes now, bar the most recent one. I love the format and how open guests have been. I like that it's a diverse group of people. Hearing writers, actors, game designers and musicians on games is really interesting. Thank you, James. He says, do we have any sports-related people coming up in any forthcoming episodes? I don't. I will get to work on that. James just does suggest Will's still the coach of Reims. So this is the chap who has led his French team to much glory. And he, I believe, cut his teeth on Football Manager. So a great story there. I don't know if he's fed up talking about Football Manager, but I will try and get in contact with him, see if I can get him involved. He also asked my last question is, do you have any Nintendo-related guests coming up? I do indeed have a fantastic Nintendo guest coming up very shortly, who's got some incredible stories from hanging out at Nintendo in the early 90s. Some real fantastic anecdotes there to share with you, so I look forward to that. Yeah, thank you. Just a very small selection of the emails and messages that I sent. Thank you for all the kind messages as well about the episode with Tom Bissell from a couple back. People really, really loved hearing from Tom. He was a fantastic guest, obviously a very eloquent human being. I think used to giving lots of interviews, but also, yeah, I mean, just so wide-ranging, knowledgeable about games. And of course, Tom has achieved great things in a diverse number of industries in which he's written. So yeah, if you've not listened to that, I do recommend you go back, have a listen to the brilliant Tom Bissell. If you would like to write to me, then you can do so at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. If you are someone who is maybe interested on coming on the podcast, don't be shy. You can email or get your person to email. I'm getting more and more requests for people to come onto the podcast, which is wonderful. I do try and get back to everyone. No promises, but if it's a good fit, then try and make that work. But anyway, if you just got some comments and thoughts and suggestions, then do get in contact, or you just want to say hi, that's all good. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter at MyPerfectConsole with the O's removed, also on Instagram. Yeah, I think that's about it for now. I'm not quite sure what community features have been released at the precise moment I'm recording this, so I won't talk about those. Other than to say, if you do want to support the podcast financially and would like to get your episodes early and ad-free, pop along to Acast Plus. Search for My Perfect Console, and you can do that for really some small change a month. It just helps keep it sustainable, and we'll hopefully keep doing it well into next year. That's enough from me anyway. I'll be back again next week with one more guest. There are 5 games and one more perfect console. Until then, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.